You're listening to Face Off, Episode 11, recorded March 27th, 2009. You're listening to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us via Twitter at faceoffshow. All right, Mark. So one of our follow-ups, we actually forgot to do this last episode because we were so excited that we had a guest, but we actually, last episode was episode 10. This
Yay!
Is 11.
So yeah, well, this one's 11, but we forgot.
We forgot. So we made it over the 10-episode hump. I don't know. Curse? I don't know. But
10's good. 100. We're shooting for 100 next time.
Yeah, well.
Well, 50. We got 50 in there. We can hit every.
We did put three numeric digits in the file name.
We did.
Hoping. If we ever get to episode 999, one, we better be rich, and two, that's a lot of episodes. I'd like to hit 100.
I like doing
day,
it,
though.
So I think we're going to be able to do it.
Yeah, hopefully. No, we have a good time. We're good. So I guess for episode 10, what I kind of want to do is give people a little background on the show. I think we may have talked, but kind of formally, what happened was one day Mark and I were talking, and we were actually arguing about Ruby on Rails versus PHP. Mark and I both had programmed a lot of PHP. I was learning Rails at the time, and Mark was resisting change, as we all do.
Yep.
And we were arguing about it, and so we thought, you know, I had been talking about doing some podcasting, and Mark said, you know, someday we should face off in a podcast about it. And we both were big fans of the old Nintendo game Blades of Steel, and so we loved the sound of the ref when he says face off, and so it became like a running joke. So what we did was we kind of took the theme song, and we made the theme song and called it Face Off because we figured we would argue about everything.
Before we even podcasted, we're like, you know, that would be a good name for a podcast and good theme song.
Yeah, and like, we're going to face off about stuff all the time. We'll argue, you know, good points, have good discussion. And then the truth is we started working together a lot more, and the truth is we don't argue about much, so we don't really face off, but...
We're
face to face.
So if we're facing off.
If you folks could see us right now, we're face to face, eye to eye. But anyways, episode 10. So I mean, if you've listened to us through all 10 episodes, thank you. What subscribers and listeners we have out there, we always appreciate. So
yeah, and we look forward to doing more. So
yeah, exactly.
We're not going anywhere.
No,
we're still here.
I hope we're not going anywhere. That would be a bad sign. So hooray for episode 10. And this is episode 11, and here's to many more. So cheers to you, Mark. Cheers.
All right.
So another sort of news and follow-up. News-wise, we use Ustream here at the show. Sometimes when we record, depending upon our mood, we actually stream it via Ustream service. So this was actually announced, I think, about a month or two ago, but I started working with it recently, so I kind of want to talk about it a little bit. It's Ustream's new pay service called Watershed.
All right. And what is it that you're paying for? What do you get?
You're paying for no advertisements. Ustream started putting ads in their video stream, not like pre-roll, but like kind of text ads that overlay.
Okay, so like YouTube?
Yeah, YouTube overlay ads. And it's recently become somewhat unstable if you want to record, record or broadcast.
Bandwidth.
So they offer 99.9% uptime, plus the ability to customize the player how you want. You could do things like... put a logo down in the corner. You can change the colors of the players to match your website's theme. And mainly what I want it for is the uptime. And because I'm going to be using it at work, and I don't want any ads. So what's nice about it is, you know, you don't even have to log in to the Watershed service. You customize your player and you do everything you want. And all they give you are the embed codes for the player, the broadcaster, and the chat.
Okay.
So, you know,
you don't have to use Ustream.com's URL.
No, you don't go. You put on a local page.
Mm-hmm. But you could embed the regular Ustream too. But the regular Ustream stream in your site.
Yeah, you can do that with Ustream. But
this allows you to customize colors and do a few more things and have the uptime ability.
Or when you broadcast on Ustream, you can embed it into your own site, but it also shows up on Ustream's site. No matter what.
This one could be private if you wanted.
There's no real social website to Watershed. It's really just if you want to broadcast video, here's the embed code to broadcast your video. You can customize and do what you want. There's no like social stuff. I mean, you can have a chat room if you want, but
but you could have like let's say a private lecture that you can invite people to, but it's private, so where other people couldn't see it.
Yeah, exactly. Like you.
Whereas
could,
you can't really do that on Ustream. Once it's when you're streaming, anybody can come.
Yeah, I think Ustream even may have a private. I'm not sure, but this. Yeah, so I mean. It's just it seems cool. It's one of the, there's some other good services, but here's the really cool part about it is you pay the base payment model is you pay by usage. You pay by viewer hour. So if you get one viewer for 1 hour, that's one viewer hour. If you get two viewers for a half an hour, that's one viewer hour. And you pay by that. So you know, if you have a stream that you know, like other services, I look at like Mogulus, I think it's called. And they want flat rates, and it's pretty pricey, but it's cool. They have a lot of cool stuff. But I've used Ustream, and it's really simple. I just want that. Like I don't really want my web interface to do a bunch of the transitions and stuff like that. I want all that to be done on my side, and I just want to pipe the video out.
I like services where you can kind of pay as you go. That way you have limited risk. You're not paying a big upfront fee to maybe not use it much.
So that was the thing. It was hard to sell to my boss this nice premium service for, you know, $250 a month. But here it's like, well, it's a new service that we're starting with some streaming stuff on campus. Viewership's going to be pretty low, or we can gauge it. Or if viewership's really high, then, you know, maybe we can say like, someone else higher up, you know, maybe this needs to come out of someone else's budget because there's a lot of, it's a demanded service. And you can get things like analytics, like their number of viewers per, I mean, obviously if they're charging you by viewer hour, you have to be able to see how many viewers per hour to see how they're charging you. So you can gauge usage and see how many people came. So you can report that back, or you can just, Ustream doesn't offer that sort of service.
Looks like you can do 16:9 aspect ratio and high def stuff. I don't think Ustream does high def. Regular Ustream service. So that's a plus.
I haven't played around with it too much, but mainly it's just the uptime guarantee and the no ads are the big reason I used it. But it's nice because I think Ustream, as far as all the different services go, it's the one I like. I think it does what I want the best. And the only problem I've had recently when I've done some stuff using their free player is reliability of things like broadcasting usually is pretty solid, but lately we've had trouble and recording has been terrible. So if you want to record it and view it later. So
looks like they've got some notable customers here too, like Duke University, Berkeley and stuff. So I think, you know, MSU is a university going on with this is probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know.
I hope. And really the hard part though is getting people to recognize that you have that service available and getting people to pay for you to go stream it. So hopefully it'll take off. And
would you recommend it how much have you used it so far?
I mean right now decent? I'm pretty much in the test phase. I haven't really done.
Okay. So something to check out. You're not necessarily like.
Well, we're committed to it. I mean, uses it.
You've been selected to receive a free Nintendo Wii. All
that's you, buddy.
That wow. is terrible.
You know, the truth is, I'm not going to edit that out. Mark, you just got bit by an ad on the air.
All right. Anyways.
Wow. Rule one when recording audio. So it uses Ustream's backend. It uses Ustream's interface. It's all the same. There's nothing to change about it. I know how to use it. I know how it works. Ustream, even as a free service, has been reliable and solid enough that I feel that, you know, going with a pay service that uses the same backend but just gets rid of ads and has guaranteed reliability is good enough for me.
Sure.
So I hope to report back. I think it'll work out good, but I know it's cool that to see a company like Ustream trying to monetize on something besides just spitting ads out to you, you know, because that kind of gets old after a while. I mean, I like ads for monetizing, but, you know, it's good to see that they're, you know, like universities where we should outsource something like this. The reason I did it first, or the reason I wanted to change services, was before we used a local server we had with QuickTime streaming server, which I have fought with so much. I mean, it's just to the point of I can't fight with it anymore to make it work solid. And this always works.
Yeah, and I myself prefer Flash over QuickTime video formats.
Oh yeah, as a viewer, yeah. I mean,
well, especially me as Linux, using Linux as my primary operating system.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing is, people may or may not have QuickTime installed, But in the YouTube generation, I mean, everyone has Flash and it works.
Yep.
So, yeah, I agree. It's a great
thing. And they're using user voice for their feedback thing, which I thought was kind of interesting. We see that everywhere.
That is everywhere. I mean, I see how useful user voice is, but I really feel like we're missing something.
I do.
I don't know. If someone could explain it, we'd appreciate it. So we have another update on Internet Explorer 8. So, Mark, what do we got here?
Well, last episode we were talking about Internet Explorer 8. They just released their new version of the browser. It's now version 8. It's still in beta, isn't it?
I have no idea.
I think it was released. One thing's for certain, they're not pushing it out yet.
They're not pushing it through Windows. I think it's an optional update on Windows Update. I'm not 100% though. I honestly don't use Windows enough to say with certainty.
Okay. So this is their first versions. Well, this is their first major update to their browser since Internet Explorer 7, which was introduced in like 2006. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we talked about it last episode, but it's their new version. The news is it's already been hacked.
Awesome.
So their security is not so secure already. The hacker who identified himself as Nils managed to break Microsoft's safest browser in a matter of a few hours after the browser was launched.
Wow.
And was running on Windows 7 beta platform.
Wow.
So that's that.
That makes you wonder, is it the browser or is it the Windows 7 part? I mean, does the proof of concept work on all operating systems, including XP, Vista, and 7 beta?
It's saying with a little tweaking, he ran a sleek exploit against IE8. So I think it was mainly about the browser.
Mm, okay.
Actually, it says it's still unknown whether the vulnerability exists only on Windows 7.
Aww.
So I don't know. But he did win a prize for finding it and everything else.
the Microsoft gold star of...
Well, no, he won $5,000 in a laptop.
What?
Yeah.
So a company, what was it, like the Mozilla Foundation put on a contest?
Pwn to own. Well, no, this one isn't pwn to own, but there was a pwn to own where the prize was $20,000.
Okay.
Is that funded? Or well, the winners of $20,000 and all the combined prize, I guess.
Wouldn't that be evil though if like the Mozilla Foundation was
sponsoring him?
Sponsoring this.
Well, but remember in the Pwn to Own, all the browsers were hacked. So this isn't, I mean.
I mean, if anyone looks and there's enough money sent, then definitely any of them could be hacked, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's just because we talked about it and it's new and we were like, haha, I mean, all browsers are pretty vulnerable.
Well, we find more and more that all software is and. Like in Windows, I mean, a lot of people run their Windows updates and virus scanner updates and things, but they don't update some of the programs they have. Adobe Reader, you know, the Acrobat Reader had a bunch of vulnerabilities just recently. People don't think to kind of update some of these pieces of software, and it's kind of difficult to find that they need to be updated.
Well, and they don't have a unified update platform. Like Adobe tries to push their own, Google has their own.
Right.
You know, the operating system itself has its own, and it's like if you want. You know, you can probably try and pipe your updates to Windows updates, but I think Microsoft wants to charge you an arm and a leg for that, and it has to be the most solid update ever, because, you know. And it's like, so, you know, I mean, on half of my computers, when the Adobe Updater pops up, it's a pain, it sucks, and I close it, and I don't want to deal with it, so.
And if you wanted to update your software, you'd have to go to inside each individual software, use their update version, or go to the website, download the new one, remove the old one, install the new one.
And use it regularly enough that if it does have an updater, the updater fires, because most updaters don't just fire up, they fire when you fire the program. Like, the Adobe one, you open up Acrobat.
So you would never know that there was a security problem.
Yeah, you could have a vulnerability and not even know it, because, you know, that little Adobe Reader thing sitting in your tray, but you didn't launch the program.
So in Linux, you can update all of your programs with one command. Well, in most distributions of Linux, you can update all of your programs that have security updates with one command. The reason I believe they're able to do this is because they're open source and they have one unified updated system.
Yeah, I mean, you can update software that you installed via the repositories. Updates are then pushed out through the repositories.
Windows doesn't really have that luxury because all the software comes from all these different places. So you don't have one repo that has all the software in Windows.
And you could. I mean, they could. But I don't think they just, they're not a company to put resources into something like that unless they can make money off of it. And companies, I mean, if
well, they could charge companies to put them in the repo, but then which company would do that?
Yeah, exactly. It's, when they're just like, oh, I'll have my dudes just code up their its own updater in 5 minutes, which is absolutely terrible. I mean, it, no offense, I love Google, but even like the Picasa updater on the Mac, it pops up every time I open a Picasa and I click install updates and it says updates failed. And I haven't gone to Google's website and downloaded the new Picasa, because if you're going to code an updater, it sure as heck better work. I am almost not upgrading it to spite, you know?
But my point was that you're usually updating your OS, but you're not updating the application, and it's usually the application that has the fault.
Yep, exactly.
Like we're seeing in the browsers, if you're not keeping your browser up to date, you're having some sort of bug that then they can take control of your operating system.
Yeah, exactly. It's backdoor.
So it's usually the amount of programs and what you have installed, and I guess my point is that you need to be checking, I guess, all the different pieces of software. And this is the reason why they're finding vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I mean it's difficult, like to kind of bring it back to the web technology front. When you have commercially, you're doing a lot of third party applications. Like you and I, we do a lot of WordPress. You know, I use BBPress, I use PHPBB. All these different open source web applications. And unless they're like WordPress, which has a darn easy way to upgrade it, it's hard to keep track of all those. And again, that's people are getting access to your operating system through your web app. You know, it's the same problem. Like, well, you know, if you or you know PHP or something like that, they can get a vulnerability through there to your operating system. You have to make sure that stuff's updated. It's similar to like using a web app to gain root access to like a database when mm-hmm. It's not the database vulnerability,
right?
It's the application that you freely give access to the database to. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, it's hard to keep up with that stuff. I mean, you have to use something like OSVDB, the open source vulnerability database, mm-hmm. to really keep track of all that, because it's...
Or bug track. Or both.
Yeah, but I mean, with at least the open source
vulnerability you're right.
database, you can follow each vendor.
And bug track is in there, so yeah, you're better off following OSVBD.
Yeah, so I mean, it's tough, but I mean, try and be vigilant both on your desktop and in your web apps to make sure that you're keeping things up to date. I mean, as a Rails user, they update Rails more than I think Adobe updates Acrobat Reader, because there are new versions all the time. And mm-hmm. I mean, I'm kind of a novice user, so I can't keep track of that in any way, shape, or form. It's tough to do.
All right. The other thing we want to talk about on IE is we found that they have an automatic content filtering
feature, I would call it. This is, I'm interested. It kind of spins me around in my head a little bit. I'm kind of like, well, I don't really know what they're talking about, but at the same time, why don't you go ahead and give us a little overview about it?
Okay, so the way I understand it works is you turn this filter on, and you can set it from a range from about 3 to 30, okay? Uh-huh. And what this range is saying, if you see a certain script on three different domains but the same script, I want you to turn it off. Okay. Or you could set it to, I don't know, 10 or 20 or whatever. So then once you have this lit, and then also they'll be turned off. And then if you decide later on, you could say, I don't know, I see that Google Analytics is involved in like hundreds of sites, and I don't really mind that Google Analytics takes my data. Mm-hmm. They don't take anything, you know, too, it's not too private. I mean, it's just browser information.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I'll give them my data. So I'll allow that app. But here's the thing, is they could say, I don't want to see ads. I want to just block them all. All these sites seem to have the same ad delivery mm-hmm. content, and I don't need to see those.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is kind of controversial.
Yeah, it seems very controversial. Or, I mean, like another thing, you mentioned analytics. It's, I mean, as a site owner, that does me no good if people block analytics, because mm-hmm. then, I can't sell my website to advertisers to stay afloat. Mm-hmm. You know, or even if you block ads. I mean, it's easier if people block ads, because I can't detect if they block ads. Mm-hmm. But I can say, man, my visitor numbers are really low because the global analytics script got disabled in everybody's IE because they visited site, you know, 30 sites with it in it. Like, well,
yeah, you could compare your Apache logs with Google Analytics.
Yeah, you could, you can't, but I just wish it would work in the first place.
No, I know, but you'd catch it that way, I guess. But yeah, so it's kind of controversial. I mean, you have the option, I guess, to disable pretty much every ad on the internet because it's going to be able to detect them all.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm one of those people, as a nerd, I want to disable ads and I want to run ad block and everything like that, you know, because it slows my computer down and they're annoying. But as a businessman, I don't. So I tend to not because, I mean, I understand. You and I understand. I mean, we're running websites here, you know, with a little Google AdSense on them, trying to get just a little money, mm-hmm. you know, from what work we put out. So I personally don't block ads for that reason.
Right. And I mean, the ad blocking thing is nothing new. Opera has it built in. Firefox has an ad block script that mm-hmm. you can install. I think it's called ad block, actually.
Yeah.
but here's an example. With IE, you know, the user voice feedback button?
Yep.
That would start just disappearing.
Yeah.
Because it would see, oh, there's yeah. five sites with the same script. I'm just going to disable it.
Yeah. So, and as like the future of cloud services comes about, things like user voice, you know, a cloud service where they focus on one thing and mm-hmm. let other websites, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it enabled by default?
No.
Okay. That's good. Because if it was, that would be really, I mean.
Yeah. No, they're not doing that.
I don't know. Is this, I mean, it's kind of innovative. I'm kind of split on it because it's kind of innovative, kind of not. I mean, Firefox plugins have done this for a long time.
Well, nothing's been automatic like this that I know of.
True.
With AdBlock, you have to put in a script, and I don't want to call them regular expressions because I don't think they are, but there's some sort of wildcards for URL domains. Like you could block ads. Well, AdSense is an easy one because you just block, you know, Google Ads dot star dot double click or whatever.
Double click is a big one, yeah.
And you'll never see a Google ad ever again.
Yeah. So I don't know. I would encourage people to, I encourage advertisers to have non-intrusive ads, right. And I encourage web users to allow ads and be tolerant of them. I really do. Because I mean, you know, I don't want annoying ads. I don't want ads that cover up my page without asking me or start blaring music and stuff without talking to me. But I definitely do not want. I don't want to lock all the ads because people need to make some money, right? You know.
Yep. So
okay. All right. Let's move on to some web apps. That was kind of a downer discussion.
Yeah. Let's get off of that. I mean, I don't know. I think it's a great feature, but or not a great feature. I think it's new and it's something that detects content. And I think in using the right context, it could be used for something, but I'm not sure about, you know, for the ad blocking and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like maybe they could use it to, I don't know. I'm split just like you, I guess.
Yeah. It's a tough call because I mean, also it's Microsoft and we're kind of hard on Microsoft, but at least they're trying new stuff. So. All right, Mark. So I'm going to bring it back to some web apps here. The first web app I wanted. Oh, this is actually your web app.
Yeah, this is the one I found here.
All right, Mark. So why don't you tell us about
it? Okay. Actually, well, the person that I saw this from or found this from was on Twitter, and I'm going to get him in the show notes, but I can't remember his name. He actually listens to our show.
Yeah, some guy in the UK.
Yeah, I forgot his name, and we're going to get him
like
in the show notes.
It's like UM2.
H2MK.
H2MK. Yeah, okay.
Maybe. Anyways, this script or this program is called SpellR.us.
SpellR.us.
Okay.
So what does this do, Mark?
Well, what it does is you put your URL in there, your top level domain or whatever, and it'll go through your entire site and find spelling errors.
Oh.
And it is actually I tried it and it's very, very smart. It's not going to pick up like product names and say, oh, this is misspelled or.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not going to pick up, you know, it's very, very, very well. Very, okay. Like good.
So I put in jaderobbins.com into this. And it what's really cool is it even sort of categorizes your spelling errors into like ones that it knows you misspelled,
yeah,
ones that you may have misspelled, like words that, you know, maybe are buzzwords, and then there's like a bunch of others that they think are probably not errors, but you might want to look at anyway. So I had zero likely errors, oh, which really? Are the big red flags, 38 possible errors, and 94 unlikely errors. Hmm. But
and the other thing I noticed too is that you can put like UK like slang, you know, like different culture
words,
like, yeah, like, well, you
cultural
know,
they specific,
yeah,
words,
like color,
yeah,
can be spelled a few different ways, you know,
yeah, color. Exactly. But so I mean, oh, well, that's good and that's bad, because if I mean, I want colored spelled c-o-l-o-r
here.
Did
you
spell color? Yeah,
here you do,
yeah, but I that's how I want it on my website. Is it gonna say,
well, you say, yeah, well, no, you say it. I want a u.s spell check, and then, oh, you, then okay, color would be that way. If you sweet did uk and you spell it c-o-l-o-r,
it would be misspelled
probably. I think they do.
Awesome. So I mean, this is a pretty good service, and it's free, but they also have a pay version. What does the pay version get you?
Well, the free version, you only get 100. It only will spider down 100 times.
Okay.
Or 100 pages.
Okay, so it only dig 100 deep.
So what it does, yeah, so it starts off your top level and it says, oh, you got some links. I'm going to follow these links. Then I'm going to spell check those pages. And then I'm going to follow those pages, find some links, follow the next page. So it spiders down. Mm-hmm. And as soon as it hits 100, it just quits looking.
Okay.
So the pay version is, they have tiers, I guess. They've got an unlimited pages, and they've got like 500 pages, or you know, whatever.
Okay. And
when it finds a spelling error, it not only will tell you and tell you which page it's on, it'll actually show you the page and it'll highlight the spelling error for you. That's, and it'll nice actually scroll down to where the spelling error is if you have longer pages and things. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good. It's because it gives you a useful service for free. And an even more useful service for money that, you know, I could see a company paying for this. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like a, because I'll be honest with you, I am a terrible speller. I am really bad about it. Sometimes it's not even just my spelling, it's my speed typing, yep, you know, and sometimes it's really weird, but between WordPress's spell check and Firefox's spell check, even then sometimes things get misspelled. So this is pretty cool. I like that it categorizes it too, because, I mean, there is a lot of play with language, especially on the web. I mean, I'm trying to be as professional and forward as possible on my website, but not everybody is. And so the fact that it kind of says like, well, you know, if you can look at the red ones and really fix those, because those are really obvious. But mm-hmm. other than that, then it kind of gives you like some play to say, well, you might look at the, you know, the possible ones. Like one I have is web technology is one word. Mm. Which is not right, but it can be. You know, I think it thinks it might be like internet slang, or even I think it's a tag. So it says, you know, I think I just made a web technology tag with no space. So it's saying like, well, this is a tag, so it might not be misspelled. So it kind of puts it in that gray area.
Yeah, I used it on a site that I was redesigning, and I found it only found one major spelling error, but I'm glad I found that one error.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you look bad. People like me who are bad at spelling, if we see spelling mistakes, we don't really care. But people who are really sort of anal retentive about spelling really look at it poorly. I mean, when someone spells bad, it really frowns upon you.
Yeah.
So that's a very cool app. I like it. It's I like these apps where it's like, make yourself better by sending yourself here and having it check. I like that it checks your whole site for you. You don't have to copy and paste your content in and stuff. It's very intuitive. So,
all right.
So the next web app I want to show you is called WikiRank.
Okay.
So what WikiRank does?
WikiRank. Maybe it was just my hearing. I just like to make fun of you.
So what it does is sort of rank Wikipedia searches and activity on Wikipedia. So on the far right, you can see that they have the most read articles in the last 30 days. And the first one is the Beatles. And it even has these amazing, like these sort of like really cool 30-day graphs that show, you know. So like the Beatles are really pretty steady. Like nothing really happened with the Beatles, but people are looking at the Beatles a lot, right? Mm-hmm. But Watchmen in the last 30 days had a really big spike, and then it just kind of like plowed back down. And, you know, St. Patrick's Day, obviously there's nothing. And then towards the middle of the month, it just shot straight up to, you know, to hell and back. And And then on the other side, they have kind of like trending topics where you can see, you know, kind of like, so the Lloyds Bank coprolite, which is a large human coprolite or fossilized dunk specimen.
That's cool. Has increased... Is this Wikipedia.
Yeah. It's based off Wikipedia. And
well, like, I mean, is Wikipedia running it?
I don't think so.
How do they know this information?
I have no idea. Does Wikipedia have... They have to have an API. Do they? They have to.
Wiki rank is not associated by Wikipedia. Content is licensed by somebody else. So they... I am interested to know how they're getting this information. Maybe they do have an API.
But another cool thing. So...
Okay.
I'm going to go back to the features because this is one cool one. Is at the top, you can search for an article and get specifics on that. So I'm going to search for Montana. And it takes me to, you know... Right away, just says the Wikipedia page for Montana was viewed 101,053 times in the last 30 days. And it gives me sort of a same thing, a 30-day graph as to the traffic. You know, you can kind of see during the week it gets higher and on the weekends it's a little less. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, on the 23rd of March, it spiked up to 8,000 views in one day.
Wow.
So, I mean, what happened there? I don't know. But you can, you know, you can go back 30 days. You can compare 90 days. You can see the traffic over 90 days. It's kind of like Google Analytics for Wikipedia, but for everybody.
This is interesting. So I did the Bozeman. It's, you know, about 50 views per day. And then all of a sudden during that...
the downtown explosion.
Downtown explosion, we got 342 views in one day.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see the spike.
Yeah, it went crazy. So it's really cool. I mean, I know you're like me. If I go to Wikipedia... you know, all of a sudden, 3 hours later, I'm still on Wikipedia reading articles, learning stuff, and I kind of say, where did the time go? So Wikipedia really interests me. I think it's pretty cool. But, you know, if you want to take a look and get some information and some stats on articles on Wikipedia, go to wikirank.com.
I just want to clarify, I just read here that where they get their information.
Okay. So oh, really? How do they do that?
Yeah. It says WikiRank is based on the logs from Wikipedia's HTTP SQUID proxy servers.
Hmm.
That means every single page load is recorded, whether initiated by a human or a browser, a web spider, blah, you know.
Uh huh.
But that doesn't mean that they actually can, you know, they can filter those out from there. But then, so it's interesting. So that's how they do it.
Oh, that's cool. So it's not, there isn't an API, but you can download. Does Wikipedia provide it to them, or,
you know, I'm not sure, but it does. That's how they're getting it. So,
huh? Well, that's cool.
And they're using user voice.
Yeah, man, it's all over the web. It's crazy.
All right,
those guys, I think, are doing pretty well. I actually listened to an interview of the creator, founder of User Voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's really funny because he started out as a back-end programmer. And when they were working on a project, which is a calendaring program, and one of his ideas to make this calendaring program better was to make it a sort of advanced feedback mechanism, and the calendaring program failed, so he started up his own company doing the feedback stuff. So
I see.
He seems like a pretty cool guy with his head on really straight. So very cool.
What's our next app?
The next app is called WeFollow, which is it says that WeFollow is a user-powered Twitter directory. This is, I've seen a lot of people on Twitter. I think this just kind of broke out in the past couple weeks or so because a lot of people started doing it. But what it does is you go to WeFollow.com and they have all these different tags. And what you do is you sign yourself up on WeFollow.com and you can pick three tags to describe yourself. So like me, I did entrepreneurship, web technology, and podcasting.
Okay.
As my three tags. I submitted it myself. So now what I can do is I'm listed in those tags. So what it has is all these different tags like celebrity, news, actor, politics, tech, and based on like the number of followers, it can kind of rank you. So like on the first page, one of the hashtags it shows you or the tags it shows you is celebrity. And like obviously there's like, you know, Britney Spears, Jimmy Fallon, and Shaq, and Lance Armstrong.
The real Shaq.
Because
there was a fake Shaq account.
Yeah. If you listen to Shaq's tweets, he is ridiculous. I mean, he is like, it reminds me of like Kanye West blog posts. Have you ever seen those?
We talked about it in another podcast about his MySpace and capital.
Yeah, he's like, he types in all caps and just really spouts off whatever is on his mind.
Actually, it's funny you mentioned that.
Shaq's latest tweet is in all caps. You see that?
Yeah, he uses a lot of all caps. It's poor netiquette. So, but
Shaq, if you're listening, you need to not type in caps all the time.
You know, Shaq, if you're listening, you need to come talk to us because
his bio location is in caps and his everything is in caps. His username is in caps.
Yeah, he likes caps.
Well,
anyways, what this is really cool is there's a lot of things you can do with this. It sucks that you can only do three, but it kind of prevents spam because you have to like pick your three ponies and you have to stick with them all the way. One thing I'd be interested to see, and the hard part is I can't log back in and change my tags. I don't like that.
Oh, you can't? It's just a one-time thing.
I think it's a one-time shot, man. And so afterwards I thought, you know what would be kind of a good idea is if one of your tags was like your hometown or something like that. So, you know, I'm here in Bozeman. I thought about it after I said I should have made one of my tags Bozeman. That way, you know, because you can go to any tag. So I could go to like the Bozeman tag and anyone else that joined WeFollow that put the Bozeman tag, I could see all their tweets right there. I'm in the entrepreneurship one. I can try and find, and it's nice that it ranks it by the most followed. So I can see, you know, I don't know everybody on Twitter. So I can click on those and be like, man, that guy has a lot of followers in the entrepreneurship section. What am I missing out on?
Right.
Maybe I should be following. Maybe he can teach me some good lessons. So it's a good directory, and it has like some, you know, like other little goof or fun Twitter things, like the most, you know, top Twitter users is CNN Breaking News with 681,000 followers, and then Britney Spears and Barack Obama. Barack Obama has been knocked off his pedestal. Can you believe that?
What do you mean?
Barack Obama was the most followed person on Twitter.
Oh, and he's
for
not,
as long as I know, Britney Spears and CNN Breaking News are beating Barack Obama.
You know what's funny is in the Britney account. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
It's terrible.
They've got so many people in that Twitter account. They've got like Britney's manager. So every tweet has the like who it is. They put who's actually talking in the tweet.
Yeah. Because so many people.
But she actually does tweet in there now.
Well, like once in a while.
Yeah.
I looked at it a long time ago, and this is before they were saying who was actually tweeting. And it was annoying because they were using it completely the wrong way. You're like, no, I can't tell who's tweeting or who.
They're a little bit like the last time I looked, it was like, oh, I'm bowling. I didn't get a 300 or I don't know. and then it said by Britney or whatever. And then like it'll say her, blah, check out this website by her manager or whatever. Yeah. You know, his manager's name.
That's okay.
Kind of thing.
I don't know. It's hard there because like she has a personal brand. But it's also like a corporate brand herself, you know? So how do you, I mean, we talk about that sometimes, like trying to manage your personal brand versus a business brand. But that's a really tough one because, you know, Britney Spears would tweet. She does tweet, you know, but at the same time, the corporate engine sort of behind her is saying, oh, man, you've got all these followers. I got to post this link to this video of your new music video so that we can make money, you know? And she's just like, I think the one tweet I saw from her was like, I'm in Japan. The cars are so small. They're cute. And I was like, that. I knew right away that was Britney Spears because the other ones were like, oh, check out my new music video. And then it was like, cars are cute in Japan because they're small.
So her latest tweet, had a great dinner with all the dancers last night, Britney.
Yeah. So, and the Ellen Show is going. Ellen Show has a lot of followers. Holy cow. How did I miss that? 426,000 followers, the Ellen Show. I had no clue.
She just joined Twitter like within the last 2 weeks, too.
Wow.
And I remember getting a retweet saying, follow her because she's trying to get a bunch of things before her show or something.
Wow. That's weird.
So she's new to Twitter, actually. So that was fast.
Yeah. Wow. So I'm looking at the top Twitter users from WeFollow. And like, there's a lot of them on here that I didn't know. I mean, Kevin Rose is number 13. I thought he would be like number one.
Well, Leo used to be number one for a while, and now he's got beat out.
Yeah. And like it sometimes, though, it kind of makes me lose faith in humanity because like Perez Hilton is number 16. But Woot is 19. Nice. And I love Woot. So Anyways.
But yeah, I mean, it's cool. You can check out the little different hashtags. You say, I want to check out the blogger people or...
Yeah, and really, I mean, try and hopefully find smart people who are in the same sort of genre as you and get, you know, good tweets from them. So check it out, wefollow.com. Mark and I both tagged ourselves in our categories today. So
you can find us in there under the entrepreneurship. You're in podcasting. I'm under Linux and some other things. So.
Yeah. I have a feeling I won't be near the top, though.
Yeah. Someday.
Someday.
All right, what do we got next?
All right, so the next thing in our last little web app before we hit at least a topic or two is called Zamzar. I think I'm saying that right. ZAMZAR.com. And what this does, Mark, is this is an online file converter.
Okay.
So, I mean, how many times... anything like a Word doc or something, and you just need it converted to a usable format without downloading X piece of software that's full of junk that's going to put 12 icons on your desktop
all the time.
And you just need to convert that file. Well, Zamzar does that for you. So you upload the file you want, you select the file type you want to convert it to, and you give them an email address that you want them to send it to you, and boom, you're done.
This is an awesome service. However, I just got a pop-up, and I have a feeling this was the site that caused the little audio clip we heard this earlier in the podcast. Hopefully, that's not the case, but I just got a pop-up.
Well, I mean, they really have no other way to monetize that, from the service.
That was the thing I was going to say next, is they almost have to, because here's the thing. They offer you 100 gigabytes of space to put... And they say you can convert up to 1 gigabyte of files.
Yeah, that's hardcore.
That's crazy.
So, I mean, and you don't want them to, like, insert ads into your file when they convert it, right? I don't want to open up my Word doc and see an ad in there or something.
I mean, I actually wouldn't mind a pop-up or whatever if I wanted to convert, like, a Word document and I couldn't convert it because I didn't have the software and I was on another person's computer or whatever.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind it.
I mean, they have a lot of file formats you can convert to. I mean, the one thing I didn't get a chance to do, and I think it would be cool if it did, is like convert a PDF to an image. I wonder if you can do that. Or even like an image to a PDF. But I mean, there's a lot of different file formats. There's all kinds of sort of...
But you can convert a video or something, a podcast. You can convert it to AUG or...
Yeah, exactly, like an open source format or anything. So, I mean, you could... And they also even have like... archive file types like zip, 7-zip, cab, RAR, tar, all that stuff. So it's pretty cool. I haven't had a chance to really use it a whole lot because I haven't had a need for it yet, but I'm excited and hope that I can use it, and I think it's going to be a good service. If they had, and I don't see anything here, but if they have an API, man.
That would be very
for a web app, handy. You know, pay for API access to convert stuff in your web app for you, because that would be, we need that so bad. I'm kind of trying to look at their pricing. Pricing seems to just be you up the online storage. You get priority. So it does take a while. It's not super instant, obviously, you know, depending upon how many people are using the service. But, you know, you get email support, secure conversion, no ads if you sign up for the $16 a month plan. But... seems pretty cool. They really just think about putting an API because this is something that I don't want to write and I would love access to on my applications. You know, I mean, how many times you can do it in, you know, Linux or PHP and stuff, but how nice would it be just to be making an API call, send this file, return back, converted file to whatever format you want, and put it up there, you know? So I don't know.
Well, especially if you're doing some kind of an online service too. No. Then you yeah, I don't know.
But
probably end up doing your own conversions at that point because you wouldn't want to waste the bandwidth to upload it, but
yeah.
Here's what it's handy for is going to like somebody else's computer or you're walking somebody you know, a family member or a friend through a computer step or document from somebody and they're like, well, I just got this open office. Well, you can either download the 200 megabyte file that you need to open it
or how many times find a CD or
how
whatever.
How many times does that happen? I mean, a million times.
Computer lab scenarios, all that kind of stuff.
So-and-so sent me a what file? You know, we talked about, what was it last week? We talked about that app that is a directory of what applications you can use to open certain extension types. I mean, this doesn't tell you much about it, but if you, you know, if you find out that it requires some goofy program to convert it, don't download the goofy program. Come here. Check it out. So, I mean, as from like a family tech support guy standpoint, you're very correct. This is a godsend. I mean, I really don't want to have to explain to my mother over the phone
how to install
OpenOffice. Yeah.
Or like the latest Office set or 2007 format or whatever.
DocX, all the X formats. Yeah. So check it out. Xamzar. It's pretty cool. Wired says it makes so much more sense to have a web service to take care of this process. And Lifehacker said, this is a kind of a good one. Xamzar sort of blows my mind. So check it out. I think they're pretty cool. Hopefully, again, this is one of those companies I hope that makes it, because I think that's a clever idea that no one's really executed, and I hope they can do. So, all right, Mark, let's get out of web app land and talk about the first thing I want to discuss with you is a little article I found called, or did you find this one? I can't remember. It's so long.
Yeah, this is kind of a topic that we've been meaning to talk about, but we never get to it because we have so many web apps and there are so many, or we get on a topic and But anyways, it's 10 advanced PHP tips to improve your programming.
Okay, so
here we go. The first one, use an SQL injection cheat sheet. Most of the times when you see a site that's got hacked or you you're doing programs and your own site gets, you know, hacked, and because it's, you know, WordPress vulnerabilities or a PHP BB vulnerability or whatever, it's almost always either an SQL injection or cross-site scripting. Mm-hmm. And so you need to know what these are.
Yeah.
And you need to know how to prevent them.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't. I'll be honest with you. I'm not an expert on it. I mean, I kind of know what they are, and I try my hardest to prevent them. I tend to just use a framework to get around that.
Right.
But I mean, if you're, especially let's say if you're doing internal development where you might not be using a framework, or if you're doing it for a customer, I mean, if it's for yourself, you can kind of take that own risk yourself. But if you're doing it for a customer or doing it for, you know, internally, you need to know this stuff and you need to make sure you're prepared for it.
Yeah. I mean, most of the time it's pretty trivial. You want to, anytime you accept stuff from the user, you want to sanitize that. The problem is you don't always think which parts of the application the user can actually control. Yeah. You're like, oh, well, here's this form and they can control that, but you don't think, oh, they can also pass Git variables in the URL or something. You know, you forget about something. So
good old registered globals and PHP 4. Yeah.
So this is kind of handy. It helps you write statements and things that are a little bit more bulletproof.
Yeah.
So
number two.
All right. So know the difference between comparison operators.
Oh yeah, this was really good because it blew my mind. I mean, I guess I've looked at this before, but I always forget about it. You know, we tend to just know equals or does not equals, but there's a lot of them I don't even think of all the time. Like three equals means are they the same type? Exclamation point equals means not identical.
Yeah, those are some of the ones you don't use as much.
Yeah, and smart people use them a lot. If you ever look at their code, immediately the first thing you do is say, oh man, they put in an extra equal sign and delete it and then sit and debug it for 5 hours. That's happened to me. And so there's, you know, there's a lot more comparison operators out there besides just the basic equals and does not equals and less than and greater than. You know, most programmers know those, but there's some other ones sometimes where you can save yourself some time.
Mm-hmm.
Number three.
All right. Number three, shortcut the else. Okay. So this is basically you're shortcutting the code, it looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, the example they use is they have an if, and then, you know, if this condition, x equals 5, else x equals 10. And the way they get around that is just setting x equals to 10 before the if statement, and then not putting an else. It makes it harder to read, but it also kind of shortens your code too at the same time. Because, it, you know, either way, at the end of the code, is it going to equal 10 if it doesn't equal 5? So instead of writing the extra code of putting an else and two brackets, you just put x equals 10 at the top and set it at the beginning, and then it'll execute the else. And if it does, it will equal 5, and if it doesn't, then it's still 10.
Okay.
So that's kind of a good one.
All right, yeah, you explained it pretty well, actually. At first, when I looked at this example, I wasn't quite sure what they were trying to mean here. I mean, I looked at it before. Yeah. Now, this kind of brings up a scenario, though. Do you write code that's easy to read, or do you write code that's efficient or you know?
That's a good question. It sounds cool, and as a programmer, you're like, well, I don't even
I'm use. Clever. I don't even have to use.
I don't even use else's because I'm so awesome at what I do. But
I've heard a lot that clever code is bad code because it's not readable.
And you recently started using. I mean, you've been using Perl, so that is becoming more. I hope more and more obvious to you because Perl people love to be clever,
right?
And it makes absolutely unreadable code. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's one of those things. Honestly, it's a cool tip because you're thinking about the program differently. You're thinking about how you're programming in a different way. Like, that makes sense to set the 10 and not put an else, but it also makes it a lot harder to read your code. And if anyone is ever going to be doing maintenance on that besides you, that's an extra step for them, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. And is there going to be much of a performance hit by putting an else in there?
See, to
maybe,
me...
Maybe, maybe so not.
Their kind of argument was, you know, keep it simple. And me looking at the code, I see what's going on a little bit better in the first example.
Yeah, with the else.
But there is a lot more programming going on.
Yeah, there is.
A few more lines.
But in your head, like when you first look at that code, you say, if this condition, x equals 5, else, x equals 10. That makes that process in your head that makes it sound, you know, human code. You know, I can say it and it makes sense logically through voice, which makes it easier.
And I don't know. This is kind of an oversimplified example, too, though. It's like X is 10. If this condition, make it 5.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know. So, again, sort of that thing. I don't think you'll take a performance hit for this. And especially if you have, let's say, a complex else statement, you know, you're going to want that bracket and you're going to want that grouping instead, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. I'm actually recently doing the Python thing, and it's all about making it totally obvious what's going on. Like, I mean, they make it dead obvious. You have to indent. You can't put stuff on one line. Mm-hmm. Well, you can, but you can't. Meaning, you can't do what you can do in Perl and put a whole huge if else then statement on one. You can't do an if else on one line.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
I mean, you could put multiple single line statements on one line as long as they're indented correctly. That one line is indented correctly and it can do mm-hmm. procedure calls. But you can't, you know,
it's not the Python way to do it that
way. Well, yeah, the Python way. That makes sense. All right. So another one that I want to talk about is number 6, ternary operators. I knew you didn't use them a lot when I first started talking to you about programming. Mm-hmm. And ternary operators, I think, are really great. It's kind of a It gives you like a one line if, but you use it when you're like doing something like echo or you're, you know, something needs a value like x equals or like echo, and then you do the ternary operator and whatever it happens at the you know, it's a, like a miniature if statement, mm-hmm. whatever it gets out of there, it returns to that spot where you're assigning the value or echoing something.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a quick shortcut, one liner if else then.
Yeah.
Basically.
Exactly. So you use, you know, you use the parentheses where you put the conditional, like if x, or no, you don't say if, but you say x equals equals 10. And then you put question mark, which is the if it's true, and then the colon, which is then the else, and then semicolon ends the statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've been trying, when it makes sense, I try to use these because it's a little bit
better. Yeah, I mean, it really makes a lot of sense when you're assigning variables or echoing a value. Mm-hmm. Or if you're concatting, like where, you know, the whole ternary operator, basically once it gets processed needs to be something, a variable or a value, you know, it's not like an if where, when, you know, whatever the true statement happens, you know, operations happen. No, it's whatever true or false happens. It's just a value that's either being assigned or appended or, echoed, you know? Mm-hmm. So they're really handy.
Another one here says Memcached, and that is like the cache like that most people use. So
really
for caching, yeah.
So
I know, like, yeah, it's like the one everything uses. So
okay, and so why do I want to cache? I mean,
well, instead of doing PHP over and over, I mean, unless the content changes, you don't need to be making all those calls. Just make a static page and then update that static page once an hour, once every 10 minutes or whatever is reasonable. Yeah.
And it does it as an operation of like PHP. Whereas my old blog used to literally, its caching function was to make a static HTML page. It would process an HTML page, save it, and then like,
yeah, that's kind of how it works.
But it did not do it efficiently. So this is, and what this does is prevent the dig effect. I mean, we've all seen this. We try and use caching plugins on all our blogs because you never know on the internet when someone's going to hit big and you're going to have, you know, 100,000 visitors and you need caching for that. Because if you die in the middle of being on the dig front page, you're never coming back. No one will like you. So number 8 is pretty good. It says use a framework. We talk about that a lot. We kind of spoke about it above. A framework takes care of a lot of your security problems and stuff for you. You have a large code base to work from. They can be inefficient because there's a lot of code you might not be using. But, I mean, these people are experts and know what they're doing, and they can take care of a lot of these problems for you.
Yeah, I would recommend learning a framework just to see how it's coded and how it kind of works, if nothing else, and to, you know, learn for rapid development.
Yeah, I mean,
you might still want to do your own code. I understand that. Like, you know, you can still do your own code, but try a framework for a while. Just try it.
Well, it's just, I mean, you'll find it after a while. It's really nice to not reinvent the wheel 20 times over. I mean, you have to keep your own little repository of your code snippets that you are using all the time. You know, I mean, how many of us had a PHP DB class, you know, database class that we just basically kind of copied from project to project? It was never unified, of course. You know, you'd copy it from one project to the next and modify it how you need it. But I mean, basically your own DB class. And I guarantee you that these guys probably did a lot more stuff to stop SQL injections in their DB class than I ever did in mine. I guarantee you that. So I'm a big fan of frameworks. I think they're the way of the future.
Okay.
Yeah, the rest are, you know, there's some good tips here and there. Some like, kind of like, really, you think that's that important tip, you know, like, what were we talking up above that, you know, the lose the else, like, yeah, really, you know, use is set instead of string length. Okay. That's not like a hot tip. I mean, I'm not like,
I use is set anyway. So.
All right, Mark. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind all our viewers that you can subscribe to our show via faceoffshow.com/feed. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can email them to us. Like if you have an audio comment, you can, you know, attach it to an email address or send us a link or something like that. We'd love to get an audio comment. If you have any suggestions, you can just email to studio@faceoffshow.com. You reply to us on Twitter. We're Face Off Show on Twitter. And leave a comment on our blog or, you know, just give us feedback in any way. Mark and I, we're always trying to make ourselves better. And this is, you know, this is everyone, all our listeners' show as much as it is our own. And so we'd really love to hear what you guys want us to talk about or what kind of things you're interested in so that we can really dig into it and see what you guys want. So we'll see you guys next week.